As we kick off the new year, many of us resolve to grow closer to God. But how do we actually do that? Well, we have a resource to help you do just that through our free ebook, 5 Ways to Connect with God. This resource shares 5 simple but powerful spiritual practices to deepen your relationship with God, from cultivating thankfulness to asking God for a word for the year. This guide will help you to find rest, focus, and renewed connection with God as we begin the new year. Download your copy now at premierinsight.org. Start your year off closer to God. That's premierinsight.org. Now, let's get started with today's episode.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. It's good to be here.
Good. And so today we're going to be talking about something called effective altruism, or EA, we'll probably start calling it because it's a bit of a mouthful. I'm going to say that word a lot of times. I'm sure some of our listeners have heard of this. Some of them will have no idea what we're talking about. It all comes because, as you people might recall from our episode on cryptocurrency, there was a cryptocurrency exchange called FTX last year, which was run by a young guy in his 30s called Sam Bankman-Fried, and it kind of exploded spectacularly, and he has now been arrested on suspicion of fraud. Billions of dollars have gone missing. But it hasn't just, as we talked about with our cryptocurrency episode, hasn't just thrown a huge spanner in the works of the kind of crypto empire, but it's also had a massive blow on the effective altruism community, because Sam Bankman-Fried was one of the largest donors to effective altruism. Before we go on a little further, do you want to try and quickly explain or define what we mean when we say effective altruism?
Yeah, it's a term which I think goes back to a very well-known philosopher called Peter Singer, who is a utilitarian, very influential, one of the most influential moral philosophers of the last 50 years. And he has said that we should really use our utilitarian calculation to guide all our giving. And he has prominently stated that he himself is giving a significant percentage, I think 30% of his income, to charities around the world, but that we should only select how to give money according to rigorous utilitarian calculations. So I think he came up with a name, and some years ago, but I think it's only really in the last decade or so that this has been taken on, particularly by a group in Oxford.
That's right. Yeah, there was a couple of philosophers, students or kind of junior researchers at the University of Oxford about 10 or so years ago who got really interested in some of Singer's ideas and kind of captivated by the idea that at heart it says all people are worth the same, but the need is not the same. And so the need of people in, you know, extreme poverty in parts of the developing world is much greater. And so our giving should be kind of ruthlessly maximized so that each pound or dollar you give away can achieve the absolute most it possibly can. And so there's a few of these philosophers, William McCaskill and Toby Ord at Oxford University who started these research institutes and private organizations which will focus on this idea of encouraging more and more people to start not just to give money away, but to give it in a kind of, as you say, utilitarian, maximally efficient, maximally effective manner, which has come to be known as the kind of effective altruism or EA community.
Yeah, and it's interesting how this has become very attractive to a sort of group of young, pretty elitist people. And interestingly, the majority are male, the majority are white, and they're highly educated. In fact, there seems to be a kind of charmed elite circle of universities, Oxford University at the centre, and then Cambridge and Stanford and Harvard. And these young people are convinced that traditional approaches to charity, traditional ways in which money is raised and distributed from the general public and by governments, is very, very ineffective. and that most of the money donated to charity is a complete waste of time. And so they're saying, we've got these clever new ways of thinking about it, and we're going to ensure that we give money in a much more focused way. And but of course, it also leads to quite interesting ideas. So for instance, you know, some have argued it's much better to become a really filthy rich banker than to become a doctor, because a doctor is limited by the number of lives they can influence. But if you become a filthy rich banker and then give money in a really effective way, you're going to touch far more lives. You're going to do far more good than you ever could do as a doctor.
Exactly right. And that's really what connects it with Sam Bankman-Fried and the FTX, the now collapsed cryptocurrency exchange, which at one point was allegedly worth, you know, tens of billions of dollars. It was handling billions of dollars of cryptocurrency in and out. And Sam Bankman-Fried very publicly said that he was doing this. He was, you know, amassing enormous wealth at a young age in the most kind of quick way he could think, which is cryptocurrency, in part so he could give lots and lots of it away. And he was giving lots of it away. Apparently he gave $130 million in 2022 alone to EA organizations and associated charities and institutions and movements. And so it's his kind of spectacular rise to prominence and then collapse has really thrown a spotlight on something that was previously a bit obscure and previously kind of dominated by kind of nerdish philosophers at elite universities. But there's an increasing number of kind of the tech world and big business and bankers and finance that has got interested in this idea, which is why we're talking about it today.
Yeah, and so there are a number of organizations related to it. One is called the 80,000 Hours Institution. And the reason it's of 80,000 hours is apparently that's what a working lifetime, that's how many hours you're going to spend in your lifetime. And so then the question is, well, you really need to choose what you're going to go into and what you're going to spend those 80,000 hours on. And are you going to choose a career which is going to make those 80,000 hours have a really maximizing impact on the world? Then there's the Future of Humanity Institute, which is very much concerned about, you know, what are now called existential risks. What are the major risks to the future and the future of the planet? And these organizations have raised very significant sums of money, millions of dollars over the last few years. And they've attracted some very high profile donors, very well-known names, who have given this a very high profile. And so you can see its attraction, can't you? I mean, you know, it's pretty obvious that, you know, I could go and spend my life, you know, in some very mundane existence, you know, trying to do good, but wouldn't it be much better? You know, think how attractive it would be that I could live a fantastic lifestyle, make huge sums of money, and at the same time do so much good.
Hmm. And they've also created an organization, I think it's called Giving What We Can or Give Well or something like that, which encourages people to sign up to kind of commit to giving 10% of their earnings to what they say, whatever organization can most effectively use it to improve the lives of others. And they also have an organization which basically looks at charities and assesses, according to the kind of EA utilitarian calculus, which ones are effective and worthy of your donations and which ones you should skip.
So where it gets really sort of interesting and kooky is what's called long-termism. So this is the idea that not only should we be trying to maximize the welfare of every person on the planet, but also we should be trying to maximize the welfare of future people who don't exist yet. And therefore, if you spend, say you've got $1 million to spend, and if you spend that $1 million maximizing the welfare of say, some thousands of people who are already on the planet, then that's pretty good. But on the other hand, if you spend that $1 million preventing an existential catastrophe in 100 years' time, which wipes out the planet, you've actually done far more good by preventing a future risk. And that's, therefore, we've got to value these future lives, which don't exist yet, as they are just as valuable as the lives which currently exist.
Should we talk a little bit about how they attempt to do these calculations? Because when we say calculation, we're not just using it as a figure of speech. EAs literally do have algorithms and formulas in an attempt to try and ascertain what is the best way to give money. And they use concepts like the quality adjusted life year. Should we try and briefly summarize what's going on there?
Yeah, so it all goes back to Jeremy Bentham, the philosopher who's close to my heart because he founded University College London, which is my alma mater and where I've spent most of my academic career. And in fact, the image of his body was preserved. He didn't believe in religion at all or the concept of eternal life, but he wanted to have an impact in the future. And so he did that by having his body preserved and insisting that his body was brought out at all future meetings of the University Council, UCL. And apparently 19th century methods of embalming were less than totally successful. And therefore, after a number of decades, his body was decaying to such a terrible extent that they've now put the remains away. And what comes out is a plaster cast of his body, completely clothed and all the rest. And it is still the case that sits at meetings of the College Council. So you have all these senior professors and provosts and everyone else, and they're sitting alongside them. It's the plaster cast of Jeremy Bentham because it's written in the Constitution. So anyway, Jeremy Bentham's big idea was that that the purpose of life was to maximize pleasure and to minimize suffering, and that we could determine whether an act was good or bad depending on to whether it increased the sum total of happiness in the world or whether it increased the total amount of suffering in the world. A good act is one which maximizes the total amount of pleasure in the world. And then one of his famous slogans was that everybody to count for one and nobody for more than one. So that's sometimes called the principle of equal consideration of interest. Every life, every individual has of equal value. And so this led to the idea of what was sometimes called the hedonic calculus, that before you did any act, you had to do this calculation in your head. If I do this act, will it lead to greater pleasure overall, or will it lead to greater pain? And part of the problem, of course, is, first of all, is it possible to do that calculation at all? I mean, how do I compare the level of suffering that I've got with the level of suffering you've got? You know, is mine worth 0.5, whereas yours is worth 0.3? You know, and is it possible to sum it up across other people? And then the problem comes, what is the scope of the calculation? How wide do we make this calculation? Is it all the people I know? Is it all the people in my family and my community? Is it all the people in England? Is it all the people in the world? Is it just human beings in the world? Jeremy Bentham was very concerned about animal suffering. And so he said, no, we've got to take animal suffering into account. So do we include the sufferings of animals across the world? Do we include other beings? What happens if robots turn out to be sentient? Should we include the potential suffering of robots in our calculation? So there's a real problem about the extent. And does it stop at the world? What about, does it include the galaxy? You know, the plot of Douglas Adams, where the world suddenly discovers that it's being destroyed in order to make way for a super highway.
That's right, yeah. In Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, yeah, it begins with... the world is due to be demolished to make way for a kind of intergalactic bypass, and the obviously the human character Arthur Dent is horrified at this, and the kind of demolition person can't really understand what the issue is. It's just one puny planet that's not particularly technology developed anyway.
Well, doesn't it say? Well, actually, the plans have been available for you for years.
Yes, for a million years in your local branch office in Alpha Centauri.
That's right. So you've really got no grounds to complain. Yeah. But anyway, the ludicrous thing is that there is at least a utilitarian argument to say that that's right. If the sacrifice of the planet could lead to the greater amount of happiness for other sentient beings across the galaxy, then it could be argued. So this whole question about the scope is a real problem.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And that's where long-termism comes in, because, as you say, it says, well, let's not just think about all people or even all sentient life right now, but let's think about those who are dead and those who are yet to come. And so Nick Bostrom, who is the philosopher who's kind of often identified as being behind this idea of long-termism, he famously argued that if you could reduce the probability of an existential risk, so something which might, you know, kill all of humanity occurring within a generation, if you could reduce that risk by just 1%, that's actually equivalent to saving 60 million lives today. And then if you take that even further, if you argue, as he believes, that at some point in the future, maybe in 100, you know, 200, 1,000, a million years time, humankind will eventually colonize the rest of the galaxy and nearby ones as well, then even a 1% reduction in the risk of human extinction over 100 or a million years is the equivalent of saving essentially incalculable lives, trillions, quadrillions, quintillions of lives. And in that, when you use that calculation, you basically say nothing we do on right now in this life matters apart from minimizing the risk of a future extinction event.
That's right. And that kind of reasoning has led to philanthropists to pour in millions of dollars into precisely those kind of calculations about how likely is it that we're going to create a super intelligent AI and that it's going to become malevolent, you know, all these kind of work which sounds like science fiction. The argument comes, actually, this is hard calculation. This is the most effective way of spending our money to try to prevent some terrible thing happening in the future. There are lots of other problems with utilitarians, which philosophers have been pointing out, you know, ever since Jeremy Bentham came up with the idea. For instance, if you take this strict idea of doing the calculation, it's better to add 10 new people to the world, even if they've got a very low quality of life, compared to adding just one person with a good quality of life. And so basically the most valuable thing you can do, are you listening, Tim, is to have as many children as possible, to keep having children. And basically, you should carry on having children until the new children that you're adding actually have a negative quality of life. At that point, you should stop, because you're no longer adding to the total happiness in the world. You know, and you think, hang on a minute, can that be right? But it also means that, for instance, spending money on people with severe illnesses or disability is actually largely a waste of time, because you could spend that money much more effectively. You could get far more happiness in the world. Spending it, you know. So, for instance, if you have one child with disabilities and you've got five children who are healthy, it's much better to focus your resources on the healthy children rather than to waste a lot of resources on the child with disabilities.
And this is where we get the idea of the quality adjusted life year, the QALY, which says, you know, it's not just about looking at, you know, I'm saving this life here versus saving this life here, which you might think EAs would see as equivalent because their fundamental idea is that all people are worth the same. But actually, that's not how it works at all, because you say, if you save a five-year-old who's a healthy five-year-old child but is going to die next year of malaria when they get bitten by a mosquito, you save their life by giving them a malaria net. You have effectively bought that child 80 plus QALYs, quality adjusted life years, which are going to be quite high quality if they're young and healthy. Whereas you could fund a treatment for a 90-year-old who has some kind of unusual cancer, and you could fund a huge cost, some chemotherapy, and save their life. But actually, if they're going to die anyway at 92, and the quality of those 2 years, because they're old and decrepit and run down and getting dementia, are going to be much lower. There's a way of assessing not just how many years you save, but allegedly the quality of those years. And that's why you can make judgments over what is the best life to save if you could choose between such a thing.
Yeah, and this is a very real thing, because the UK government uses QALYs, quality adjusted life years, in order to decide on the priority of different treatments. And what that means is that interventions at the beginning of life and with young people always buy vastly more life years than interventions at the end of life. And so when I was working as a neonatologist caring for young babies, we used to bang this drum endlessly because the number of qualies you get by investing in neonatal facilities is very high because we're caring for babies, whereas geriatrics does very badly because the number of life years you can buy. So now this is all very close to home for me. I'm thinking, hang on a minute, you know, I'm not dead yet. You know, I accept that probably it would be worth spending more money on those who are younger, but this is where issues of justice and equity, you know, they're bigger than some kind of maximizing calculation.
But to support for a second here, isn't it fair to say that actually what utilitarianism is trying to do, it might on some hard cases cause some unpalatable outcomes, but fundamentally, isn't it right to say that, like, we as Christians want people to live good lives? And we want people to live good, longer lives as possible. And so, you know, we might be unfamiliar with the idea of qualies and EA and this kind of stuff. But what it boils down to is we want as many people as possible to live as many good years. Is that not fundamentally a positive idea that we can get behind?
Well, I think in essence it is. I think the motivation is very good. And certainly, I mean, we're going to come on to sort of Christian understandings of and Christians who are promoting effective altruism. And I do want to respect the motivation. And actually, it's quite clear that Jeremy Bentham himself, he was a genuinely philanthropic person. He wasn't, you know, primarily concerned just to make a name for himself and earn a lot of money. He genuinely wanted a way of using reason and logic and mathematics to give a fair, a just, and a society where pleasure and felicity, as he put it, was maximized. So I think the motivation is good. It's just the unforeseen consequences of applying this mathematical process in a without thought. I mean, the reductio ad absurdum, you know, the logical absurdity that it leads to is that caring for dying people is a complete waste of time, because by definition, you know, the terminally ill have days to live, and wasting money on trying to help them when they have days to live is a complete waste of time. And you should focus, you know, on the young who have many life years. And yet, you know, again, you say, well, hang on a minute, that can't be right. Interestingly, that's why care of the dying has to cut. You can't use the quali method that the government uses elsewhere. It has to have a separate funding stream for care of the dying because the quali calculations don't work at all.
Mm. And this is not just theoretical for him. I mean, he said in interviews, in fact, no, he wrote a book, William McCaskill, one of the philosophers who kind of was behind starting EA in Oxford. And McCaskill says he basically laments that he spent time in when he was younger working as a care assistant in a nursing home, because he argues that someone else would have needed the salary he earned more and would have done a better job, and he could be more effective, you know, earning more money elsewhere as an Oxford academic and giving it away. Or he uses another example. He says, you know, and this would be close home for you, Dad, I know that, you know, when you were training as a doctor, you were seriously considering whether you were going to be called to go and be a missionary doctor overseas, probably in Africa. And McCaskill says, you know, a doctor who does that, a UK doctor who takes their training overseas, might be able to contribute 300 qualies each year, quality adjusted life years each year. But if you established a well-paid private practice back home and you stayed comfortable in the UK and earned hundreds of thousands of pounds a year as a doctor in the UK, you could then give that money away and save significantly more than 300 qualies each year. So, you know, there's a kind of paradoxical a pleasingness if you're a slightly selfish person, which says actually doing the thing which looks easier and better paid is actually the most moral thing as well.
Absolutely. And I hope I'm not being too cynical when I say I think that's part of the attraction of effective altruism, that it seems to tap into this kind of view that making money is the single most important thing. You know, I've now got a much better reason for making money. I always was interested in making money, but now I've got an absolutely excellent reason for making money, and that is effective altruism. So I think it's, unfortunately, and I think maybe, you know, coming back to Sam Bankman-Fried, it shows you that that there could be some pretty murky motivation behind all this. It isn't necessarily quite as clear and transparent as it claims to be.
And I think there's an excellent piece we've both read in The Economist, which we'll link to, which looks into how the movement of effective altruism has become increasingly kind of turned in on itself. And there's and as it's become better funded through people like Sam Bankman-Fried, there's a whole thicket of institutions and private companies and research grants. And a large part of the movement's fundraising is now not for, you know, mosquito nets in Africa or combating climate change and existential threat. It's about funding the movement itself, because, again, it says if you do the calculation, promoting EA and having more and more people become aware of it and sign up to the principles saves lots of qualies. And so you now have the 80,000 hours we mentioned earlier on, which is kind of was an charity about encouraging people to prioritize their careers over what will make the most difference, now says up there with choosing, you know, to work in healthcare or in developing countries or combating extreme poverty. They now say promoting EA should be one of the, I think, one of their top four priority careers and investments, because they argue that promoting the movement itself is how you're going to save the world. And I think an increasing number of people, as are interviewed and mentioned in this Economist article, are now slightly becoming disillusioned with the kind of self-obsession and inward focus by the whole thing, which has become unmoored from its original kind of altruistic aims.
Yeah, and another good example of that is that basically we only employ people from the top universities, which is Oxford, Cambridge and Stanford, because basically the brightest people will have the most effectiveness. And there's really no point in employing someone from Birmingham or even UCL, frankly, because, you know, second raters are always going to, you know, have second rate outcomes. So we're only going to focus on the brightest and the best, which surprisingly happens to be people like us.
I don't know about you, but sometimes I have big questions about life, and I want thoughtful answers. That's why we're excited that we have this resource to offer called Ask NT Wright Anything, 12 Crucial Questions About Faith, the Bible, and Life. This ebook distills wisdom from one of the world's leading theologians, NT Wright, tackling topics like life after death, the reliability of scripture, predestination, and more. It's our hope that this resource will strengthen your faith and deepen your understanding. And here's the best part. It's our thank you gift when you give to support Premier Insight this month. So don't miss this opportunity to grow in your faith. Visit premierinsight.org to give today. That's premierinsight.org. Thank you for your generosity. And now let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
But it's true, isn't it, that actually there are lots of Christians involved in the EA community and a distinctively kind of Christian movement within it, who argue that actually effective altruism is, it might have emerged from kind of atheist philosophers, but actually it dovetails really well with Christian ethics as well.
Yes, I was very interested. I've only really come across this movement in the last few days of effective altruism for Christians, but they take on their website, and we'll put the links in the notes, they take as a definition, effective altruism is the project of using evidence and reason to figure out how to best contribute to helping others and taking action on their basis. And then on the website, they go and say, well, surely as our primary goal as Christians, second only to loving God, is to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. And so the questions are, the problems is, as they put it, is not that we have a lack of opportunities, we have an abundance. You know, there are thousands and thousands of Christian charities in the UK, in the US and around the world. And how on earth do we choose where to put our money, and then the questions which we talked about last week come up. Should I donate near where I live or abroad? Is it better to volunteer my own services or to donate money? Should I focus on problems affecting people right now or potentially greater dangers in the near future? And so effectively, I think what these Christians are saying is that we can learn a great deal from the effective altruism movement, which is largely a secular and atheistic movement. They raise some concerns and issues, but, you know, it seems to me like a very thoughtful and appropriate way in.
And it's fundamentally true, isn't it, that Christianity is a religion which places a high value on giving, on compassion for the other, on service. And I mean, one example, and I was going to go on to say, and it's really good that effective altruism has got there from, admittedly, from very, very different kind of foundations. But fundamentally, I would rather secularists believed it was important to give their money to good causes than they didn't, because that is, you know, that's a good thing to do. And one example of interesting overlap is this idea that we mentioned Peter Singer in the last episode. He's very big on the idea of what we would call a tithe, of setting aside a portion of your income and committing to giving that away over the rest of your life. And, you know, many Christians traditionally have done 10%, but the number varies, and the Bible doesn't sort of give clear kind of outright commands on this issue. But it's a long-standing tradition that we should, rather than, you know, spend on yourself and then give what is left, but set aside, you know, the Bible talks about the first fruits of the harvest, and the first and the best of the harvest or the flock were to be sacrificed to the Lord. And Christians have for thousands of years understood that in today to mean giving aside part of your wealth, your resources outright, and setting aside to say, I'm going to give that away. And so it's interesting to see how these kind of secular philosophers have come up with a very, very similar idea. Often they say 10% as well as a good baseline.
Yeah. And of course, in the biblical way of thinking, it is very much related to the understanding of society and the duties we owe, particularly to the most vulnerable. And so time and time again in the Old Testament, there are these groups that are singled out: widows, orphans, and immigrants, and also elsewhere, the poor. And these are people who are particularly vulnerable and open to abuse. And therefore, God himself says, I am on the side of the widow, the orphan, and the alien, and that if you are following me, you must make practical provision for them. And so in the Old Testament law is there are provision is made. For instance, when you are harvesting a field, you have to leave a margin, which you leave for the poor and the widows and the orphans to be able to glean for themselves. So it was actually laid down in the Old Testament law. And Jesus extends that by saying, yes, we're called to love not only our neighbor, you know, my fellow Jew, the person who lives close to me, but actually he says, who is my neighbor? And then tells the story of the Good Samaritan. And that story has had a huge influence on the whole development of the welfare, Christian concerns for welfare, development of hospitals, and ultimately all the way through to the welfare state.
And I think in addition, I have a lot of time for some of the basic ideas of Christian EA, which says, you know, giving is good, as we've discussed, but also when you give, it should be thoughtful, it should be reasoned, it should be wise. And so we don't just give to the first charity that crosses our heart, our minds, or the first thing that we see walking down the street, but we should actually carefully and prayerfully consider how we can give money in a way which, you know, is most effective for the kingdom, you know, which can make the most difference for the most number of, you know, whoever the widows, orphans, and strangers are in our world today.
So have you come across examples of giving which you thought were pretty pointless and a waste of time?
Certainly. You know, I don't want to name names of individual charities, but there are certainly, particularly outside the church, lots of kind of charitable organizations which I feel are run more on sentimentality and thoughtlessness rather than a real desire to make an impact. I mean, it's the classic example people always bring up is you know, there are a number of charities in the UK that run donkey sanctuaries for, you know, donkeys that used to do rides on the beach for children and have now retired. And they are stupendously well funded, mostly through wills and legacies and wills. But, you know, these donkeys live in the lap of luxury. And, you know, I'm no donkey hater. I don't have anything against the donkeys.
Yeah, we're going to have lovers.
Big donkey lobby is going to come after us. I got nothing against donkeys. And, you know, of course, I want them to be generally treated well. But fundamentally, it just doesn't strike me that one of the greatest needs in our country at the moment is a few hundred retired donkeys after their exhausting existence of carrying small children up and down beaches for a few years.
So when we were talking earlier, you also gave an example about toys being given for Syria. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that really wound me up recently. So the other thing that really gets my goat, and where I think the EAs have a point, is that human beings are obsessed with the idea that when we give to charity, if you just give money, it's clinical and detached and soulless and destructive. And who wants to do that? That's icky. I would much rather give an item. And so you see this in the Christian world where, you know, it's very common. We did it actually growing up, didn't we, Dad, where you would put together a shoebox of toys and some toiletries and things, and that would be taken to give to a child who might not otherwise get a Christmas present somewhere in the developing world or someone living in poverty. And, you know, not necessarily a bad thing to do. We can talk about that later, maybe. But what really gets my goat recently was there was a devastating earthquake people will be aware of in Turkey and Syria recently. Very, very serious one. Tens of thousands of people were killed. Hundreds of thousands left homeless or injured. And I saw a video going around online, which was of a professional football game in Turkey shortly afterwards. And at halftime, all the fans had been encouraged to come to the football game holding a stuffed toy, a cuddly toy. And at halftime, they said, get your cuddly toy and throw it from the stands onto the pitch. And so there was this quite striking video panning around the stadium as tens of thousands of these stuffed toys were hurled in this kind of cascading waterfall, raining down onto the pitch in mountains of them. And then the players and the club staff were helping to bag them up. And they said, you know, we'll make sure that these get taken and given to some of the child survivors of the earthquake. And It was being shared incredibly positively, and everyone was saying, what a wonderful example, how generous, how wonderful. And it just drove me up the wall because it's the stupidest way of helping. Because one, it's the logistics of transferring 10,000 stuffed animals, you know, the money spent on all those vans and the people involved. And then, but more importantly, imagine you're a child who's lost your home. You're out in the cold in the middle of winter. You're at risk of probably sexual exploitation or child trafficking. You might be injured yourself. You're grieving after the loss of families. Do you really want a secondhand stuffed toy? Is that the best that the wealthy middle class of Turkey can offer the poor children surviving from an earthquake? The obvious thing to do is to give money to aid agencies that are setting up emergency relief work in the region. That's the obvious thing to do, is just to give money. But people feel so icky about giving money that they would rather do something incredibly ineffective, like throwing a stuffed toy onto the pitch, football pitch, hundreds of miles away from the affected area. So I do often feel like modern charity has got wrapped up in it's a way of making the giver feel good. And EAs say, hang on, it's not about you. It's about the recipient, not the donor. And let's think about how we can most effectively help the donor find, you know, in Christian terms, fullness of life.
Yeah. No, and I certainly sympathise with that. It's actually very difficult, though. So, for instance, you know, in a previous era when I was working as a professor in paediatrics, one of my hats was raising money for medical research designed to prevent brain damage in babies. And I was involved with a number of charities who were supporting our medical research. And they asked me to be involved in various fundraising appeals. And it was absolutely clear, you know, these were professional fundraisers who were very good at their job, but they knew what were the things you had to, you know, what were the keys that would unlock giving. And it was always the human interest story. It was always the touching, you know, video of this tiny little baby and how wonderful cutting edge science, and then, you know, talking to the parents, and if you can make them cry, if you can, you know, evoke some kind of emotion, then I found myself having, you know, a sort of conflict of interest, really, because on the one hand, this was very important in terms of funding our research, but was it really appropriate to be using what could turn out to be emotional manipulation? I mean, it was all true. We weren't telling lies. This was genuinely, these were genuine stories. And there is something very human about that, isn't there? That we, you know, that the part of the problem with effective altruism is this kind of cold calculus. This, you know, don't forget your heart, forget your emotions, get out your calculator, get out your spreadsheet, recalculate the efficiency, and then make a decision based on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And fundamentally, I guess what I'm railing against is not, it is human nature. And the fundraisers were, you know, you worked with were right. Most people in this world don't think like effective altruists. And therefore, if you want to extract the most money possible, it is good to highlight individual stories, not big numbers, and, you know, put a face on it and help people think of it as a kind of heartwarming character tale, rather than just here is a basic stats about how many qualies you're going to save per pound spent. I guess the other aspect that I think is praiseworthy among Christian EAs, it is pointing out that the disparities of a spending power can be extraordinary. I think more than we often realize here in the West, those of us who live in the West. And the example they give on this Christian EA website is two charities here in the UK, actually, a charity called Guide Dogs UK, which, as the name suggests, they are dedicated to breeding, training guide dogs, seeing eye dogs in the US, for blind people, often youngsters. And, you know, great charity. You know, there are people in this country who need guide dogs, and it costs a lot of money, about £60,000 to train a guide dog, breed and train a guide dog. But then there's another charity called Sight Savers. Actually, I think it has a Christian ethos or Christian heritage, and they're dedicated, also UK based, but they have a completely different approach to tackling blindness. And they send eye specialists and eye doctors into the developing world, into particularly kind of rural disconnected areas where there aren't big hospitals and resources. And they do these kind of mobile clinics that go around, basically find people with very, very severe but very treatable conditions like cataracts or trachoma. And they do incredibly quick, effective and cheap operations, sometimes as quick as 15 minutes, that effectively give people their sight back, you know. And so this charity, the Christian EA website, notes that, you know, you can give £100 to Sight Savers, and you are effectively giving five people upwards of a decade or two or three decades of vision back. Or you can give £100 to Guide Dogs, and you've helped raise, you know, 1/100, 1% of a single guide dog to help a single person for a few years. And you know, I'm not saying giving to guide dogs is a bad idea necessarily, but it is good that people are drawing our attention to actually your money, when targeted and spent overseas, can sometimes be staggeringly, orders of magnitude more impactful.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, so just again reflecting on what a Christian perspective on this would be, and I would want to put this under the heading of what it means to live wisely and to use our resources wisely. And this theme of biblical wisdom is a very rich and nuanced theme. you know, which you can trace throughout the scripture. And but it's very much related to practical integrity, judgment, and understanding. You know, so I think one of the ideas is that God creates not just the physical structure of the universe, we've talked about this before, haven't we, but also a hidden moral structure, a grain that goes into the universe. And the way of wisdom is to live your life along the grain of the universe. And if you live your life along the grain of the universe, not only will your life flourish, but you will be living in generous ways and helping other lives to flourish. Whereas if we live lives of folly across the grain, then things are going to go wrong. So I think that that fundamental idea of wisdom is a very positive thing. And certainly being wise in how we give our money and thinking about it carefully and thoughtfully and rationally is certainly part of it. But I think where utilitarianism as a philosophy is very, very different from Christian thinking. And that Christian thinking is that we come into this world already with a web of relationships of and duties and responsibilities. You know, so I am born into a family. I have parents, I have siblings, now I have children and grandchildren, and I have duties and responsibilities to these. But also I'm in a church community, so I have duties and responsibilities to my Christian brothers and sisters. And you cannot reduce this web of responsibilities that God has put me in to a kind of harsh, rigid, maximizing calculation. That's not the way it works. I mean, I'm called to care for my children, whether it maximizes utility or not, you know, and irrespective almost of the needs of people around the world, because my first calling as a parent is to this person I've been given. So I do think that there is a fundamental mismatch there. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting things to say about that. I mean, this comes down to what's sometimes called in kind of philosophy or ethics, the idea of proximity. And, you know, EA says quite, and utilitarianism says quite explicitly, we should eliminate the idea of proximity, that your next door neighbor is no more a worthy recipient of your time and care than an absolute stranger who lives 20,000 miles away on the other side of the world. All people are worth the same, and making ethical decisions based on proximity is unethical, is immoral. You know, on one level, you could say potentially that's a Christian idea, because we do believe that all human beings are made in the image of God, and that we shouldn't value those who look like us, who live near us, who are our friends, our loved ones, more than someone else, because every human being is made in the image of God. But I think you're right that actually it's too glib to just dismiss proximity. And actually, I think there is baked into kind of traditional Christian understandings of ethics an idea that, as you say, God has placed particular individuals and communities around us, and that we do have an especial calling that doesn't obliviate our calling to other people far away, but we do have an especial calling to those, you know, primarily, as you say, those in our family, but also those in our church family, those in our neighborhood.
Yeah, and one of the really interesting things is that it's just occurred to me that Jeremy Bentham and his concern about maximizing utility across the population is very much related to the rise of urbanization, you know, early 19th century, when you're starting to get these large conurbations. So it's no longer about living in a village and looking after the village. We've now got to find some kind of rules which work across massive conurbations. We've got to decide how we're going to distribute money and so on.
London, you know, just become the first million person city on earth at this point in the early 1800s when he's founding UCL. People are plunged into anonymity. Who is my neighbor? Who is my community? How do I know who to serve?
Absolutely. And so isn't it interesting, therefore, that the rise in effective altruism is now related to the fact that we have a global information space. We now know what's happening to lives literally around the world. We have satellites which can monitor every community on the planet. We have information about millions of billions of lives, and where therefore these kind of calculations now become possible. We're aware at a global level that they were simply not possible before.
And on, I'd like to say initially, there is some merit to that. You know, I think of, for example, you know, it was only when modern communication improved that, you know, accurate pictures and accounts of what was happening, for example, on slave plantations in the Caribbean got back to the safe metropole in here in the UK that the anti-slavery movement got going. That it was when, you know, previously people could live their lives unknowing that every time they bought sugar, they were effectively, you know, adding to the lashes on the back of an enslaved African who had been transported to the Caribbean to grow that sugar. And it was Wilberforce and the abolitionists who flattened the world and said, hang on, the person in Manchester needs to know that their cotton in the mill that they're spinning is being grown by slaves, you know, somewhere in the Americas. So on one level, that flattening is good. But I think on the other level, it's unhelpful because, as you say, we are supposed to be kind of finite creatures that are hemmed in and boundaried. We're not supposed to have this kind of bird's eye satellite view like a god who stands back and sees the entirety of creation like the Lord does and therefore has to make these complex calculations about who is best to save. God has placed us with our limits, that are good limits, in a particular place. And in some ways, it was perhaps almost better not to be aware of the infinite amount of suffering that is going on every second of every day, because it paralyzes us when actually, you know, do the good you can in the place that God has put you is not a bad principle to start. That's, you know, what we see in the good story of the parable of the Good Samaritan, don't we?
Yeah, no, I think the parable of the Good Samaritan is very profound because the whole point is that this was a chance encounter. The story that Jesus tells of the man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, he wasn't intending, he hadn't planned. And then out of the chance encounter, he sees terrible suffering, and his immediate response is compassion and self-sacrifice and a practical concern. And that parable, therefore, became very influential in the development of healthcare over 2,000 years. And that's why, for instance, the monasteries were set up on the roads where the travellers were to provide the, you know, the first aid and the emergency departments of centuries ago. And the same that happened in London, the big monastic hospitals were situated on the bridges going into London so they could provide emergency relief and care to travellers. So I think that idea that we are called to respond compassionately to the chance encounters that we have is a very deep one.
The other thing that I found fascinating while looking at the Christian EA kind of manifesto that we've been talking about, and we'll link to it, is they bring up the very real concept of scope bias, which is this idea that there's a cognitive bias in humans, which has been demonstrated by some kind of studies that we give more or equivalent value to smaller groups of people than to larger groups. And, you know, they've done studies where they say, how much would you pay personally to save or to help 10 people or 1,000 people or 100,000 people? And astonishingly, the numbers people say are relatively similar when you average it out. And it's this idea that actually we value small number of individuals that we can wrap our heads around rather than a kind of huge anonymous mass of hundreds of thousands. And the EA answer, including the Christians, say actually this is contrary to God's heart, because he values everyone the same, and therefore 100,000 people of his precious children is clearly worth more than just 10 of his precious children. And then fascinatingly, the Christian EA kind of manifesto goes on to use the parable of the lost sheep as an illustration. But when I was reading that, I was struck by actually, I think they've misunderstood the parable, and that actually it's quite the opposite. The lost sheep and the shepherd going after the one and recklessly leaving the 99 behind undefended is the perhaps the least kind of effective evidence-based strategy he could employ. But the shepherd is transfixed by the individual, the character of the individual lost sheep, and is desperate for them to return and be saved, and so goes after them. Whereas the most EA response would be, well, let's clearly build a better fence around the 99 and protect them, because there's loads of, you know, quality adjusted life years there, and let's not look after the one.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've heard it said that shepherds in the time of the New Testament were sort of lampooned as being the thickest and most stupid members of society, and therefore there's a kind of humour in the parable that, you know, it's exactly what a shepherd would do, would be to be so worried about the one lost sheep that he just leaves the 99 wandering around on the, you know, and yet, as you say, Jesus is using that as an example of his father, of the father's love and concern for individuals. So I don't want to be too hard on the Christians behind this, the Christian version of EA, because I do think their concerns are genuine, and there's a lot we can learn from them. I think we just need to do it with real thoughtfulness and discretion. There's just one other thing. We're coming to the end, but I'd just like to flag up another, I think, really very interesting thing, and that is different understandings of the future. So the utilitarian perspective regards the future as non-existent until we construct it. So it's almost like this massive tower. And as we put bricks into this tower, we are building up the future. And the future depends entirely on the choices we make now. And so this whole concern about existential risks fits very much into that view, that if we make a bad choice now, if we don't watch how we're developing AI at this point, this is going to have catastrophic consequences down the line. So the future is a construct created by human choices. Whereas in Christian thinking, there's much more this sense of a drama. There's the great drama which started before the foundation of the world, which includes the creation, which includes the creation of human beings, which includes the incarnation, the resurrection, the cross and the resurrection. And each of us is playing as bit players in a great drama. But the ultimate direction of the drama is not under our control and is not our responsibility. God himself is the great dramatist, and his providential purposes are in the way. And of course, our actions do have downstream consequences, and we're called to be wise about how we have how we behave. But we're released from responsibility about the long distance future. That is ultimately in God's hands. My responsibility is to play my bit part and to play it well.
And that is very radically different, isn't it, to how a lot of the kind of secularist long-termist understanding, I mean, we covered this a little bit in our episode last year about kind of climate anxiety and how neither of us think that despite the very, very real risks and significant dangers of climate change in the future and the importance of taking strong, urgent action now to mitigate that, we don't think the right thing is to become so transfixed by potential disaster in the future that it completely overwhelms how we act today. And there is a place for, not kind of in the kind of glib, oh, it's fine, God's got it, we don't need to worry about the future, that's clearly unchristian, but there is also a place for saying God is still sovereign and the king of this world, and we don't need to presume that everything that we do now is in some kind of like all seeing way building a future, building what comes next.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about that wonderful story, and perhaps we will finish on this, about Joseph, in where you remember the story that his brothers hated Joseph and they wanted to kill him, but then they decided to sell him to these passing traders as a slave, and he goes off to Egypt, and then the whole narrative unfolds, and it turns out that Joseph is playing this key role in Egypt as the number two to Pharaoh, and makes provision and saves thousands of lives from famine. And then he meets up with his brothers accidentally, and they are terrified that he's going to take retribution on them. And he says, "Don't be afraid, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." And so there's this fascinating idea that there were sort of two intentions there. There is a human intention, and the human intention matters, but running concurrently, running at the same time, there is a divine intention. And the divine intention was providential and ultimately for good. And there's a deep, deep reassurance in that, I think, that even though human intentions are sometimes for evil or careless or pointless, there is a deeper intention that God is at work. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't bother. I mean, you know, the whole story is about the importance of Joseph taking provision, of being wise. So it certainly doesn't release us from human responsibility, but it helps us to see a deeper narrative behind it all.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we've run out of time for this episode. I'm sure we could talk a bit more about this. But please do, if you're interested, do click through to some of the links in the podcast description and read further. It's a really interesting kind of movement. And thanks very much for everyone for kind of going along on this journey with us. As always, you can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. If you've got any questions, queries, disagreements, feedback, suggestions for future things we could talk about, please do get in touch. Do have a look at Dad's website, johnwyatt.com. Lots of interesting resources there. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.